Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning. 15 cars and 15 red blues riders, 3 conductors and 25 sacks of men. All along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulls out of Kankakee and rolls along the houses, farms, and fields. Passing trains that have no name, and freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of the rusted automobiles. Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done, dealing card games with the old man in the club car. Any point in no one keeping score? Pass the paper bag that holds the bottle. Ride their father's magic carpet made of steel. Mothers with their faces asleep, rocking to that gentle beat, and the rhythm of the rails is always me. Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done. Nighttime on the city of New Orleans, changing cars in Memphis, Tennessee. Halfway home, we'll be there by morning, through the Mississippi darkness, rolling down to the sea. But all the towns and people seem to fade into a bad dream, and the steel rail still ain't heard the news. The conductor sings his song again, the passengers will please refrain. This train got the disappearing railroad blues. Good morning, America, how are you? Said, don't you know me? I'm your native son.
Go for auto sequence start. The SRB hydraulic power units have started. T-minus 21 seconds, and the solid rocket booster engine gimbal now underway. T-minus 15 seconds. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff, and it has cleared the tower.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network calling.
The station with the happy difference.
And this is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the heartland and in the bunker. Ready for another big shoe here today, right here on off stage. Yeah.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581 is the address. Address your mail to either Box Holder or Tom Metzger or the Insurgent, and we'll get it, no matter which one you use. Yeah.
Well, Terrible Tommy here. We're in the bunker, and it is the October the 24th, 2000. 16, and we're ready to go here at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. Yeah. And boys and girls, get your donations in, because a few of you, maybe two or three, are behind. Which I'd like to have those in by the end of the month. Going into the following month, I'm afraid I'm going to have to drop people. But most people have been very loyal about it, and no problem. Well, looky, looky, looky here. Whether your friends are progressive, conservative, or anywhere in between, I bet they hate the media. In the last week alone, I've had lefty friends blame the media for ignoring protests at a pipeline in North Dakota. Right-wing friends blame the media for ignoring the emails that WikiLeaks obtained from the Russian despotic regime. And everyone blamed the media for supposedly giving Donald Trump too much press, as if the spectacle of a white supremacist, serial liar, birther, know-nothing, sexual assaulter, and tax dodger who has a shot at the leading free world is not somehow the central story of our times. This is from a Jewish publication. I think it's quite interesting. And then there's Israel. For right-wing pro-Israel folks, the New York Times is practically an agent of Hamas. For lefties, it spouts Zionist propaganda. CNN either shows too many bombs dropping on Gaza or not enough of the daily grind of occupation. Thank heavens for more objective sources like the Electronic Infodata, WorldNet Daily, and email alerts from ideologues. You never can make Jews happy. This needs to stop. It's lazy. It's false. It degrades our public discourse, and it is seriously eroding our democracy. What democracy? I don't see democracy myself. Nowhere near democracy. And if that weren't enough, its anti-elitist bias contributes to anti-Semitism. First, there are no media. I'm in the media. I write for the Forward and the Daily Beast. And I occasionally appear on television, but the media also includes Fox TV, MSNBC, and the organization Large and Small from across the country, political spectrum. Are we all in collusion together? Well, Tommy says, yeah. There isn't even any such thing as a mainstream media. Remember, the corporate media is controlled by about, the whole corporate media is controlled by 10 operations, corporations. Fox News is mainstream, so are the major networks, and while there are built-in biases towards the kinds of stories people want to read or watch, whatever ideological biases exist are clearly balanced out by folks of competing ideological persuasions. Well, that's bullshit. You know, that's total bullshit. Or these people are so screwed up in the brain that that's what they see. And that's maybe what it is. Second, blaming the media blames the wrong people. Oh, if your gripe is that we aren't talking about issues like mass incarceration, police violence, climate change, fracking, and wealth gap, or the influence of big money on the politics, then the people you should be attacking are Republicans. We should attack them all, baby, who believe that climate change is a myth, fracking is safe, and inequality is an inevitable part of the free economic system. You can see how far left this guy is. And conversely, if you're annoyed that we aren't talking enough about Bill Clinton's sex scandals, Palestinian anti-Israel educational materials, or the pernicious effect of environmental regulations on family farms, then blame the Democrats and other liberals. No, there are no liberals. The last liberal died, I think, 50 years ago. Who don't agree with these issues are as crucial as you think they are. Well, conservatism is dead. It died a long time ago. All you got is neoconservatism. And liberalism is just plain out Marxian liberalism. If you want to know why we haven't done anything about gun violence in America, the blame doesn't lie with the media. It's with the Republicans who deny that gun control will do any good. Well, it won't, because of wild-ass niggers and other people, crazy people. They're going to use a gun. They're going to get the guns no matter what. Or if you prefer, with Democrats who are so maniacally focused on gun control and mass shootings that they misattribute where gun violence is really overwhelmingly taking place, namely in individual acts of violence, suicide, and accidents, like Chicago, with 1,000 people, mostly black, being gunned down. But then the blacks that are up there want to vote for Hillary, who, if anybody's going to take guns away, it's going to be her. We strongly disagree about how to address this particular crisis, and if you want to change that, you ought to engage with the people on the other side of the issue, rather than alleging some sort of media collusion or conspiracy and not elevating your point of view. Well, no, it's not a big conspiracy. They're raised and they're educated in this way, so they automatically think a certain way. They don't see anything wrong with it, and they think everybody else should think that way too. At least notice that for everything we should be talking about, there is another we that disagrees with your take. Yeah. Don't blame the media for not being a left-wing or right-wing advocacy group. Well, they are, but above all, they're corporate advocacy group. This isn't to say that the advocacy journalism isn't important. I do a ton of it. Or that the media outlets don't often chase stories that are in fact distractions from more important topics. It's just to deny that the media is some kind of big, biased monolith that toes a particular line. Which is the biggest problem with the blame the media claim? It's a lazy, disempowering, corrosive conspiracy theory that stokes rage and reduces the space of rational discourse. Sure, that's true. Let's see here. Trump supporters saying the media is biased towards Hillary Clinton are no different from Bernie Sanders supporters who said the same thing. They're alleging conspiracy. Well, if the shoe fits, wear it, undermining the process of journalism that distinguishes careful edited reporting from mere blogging and bloviating. Indeed, one should easily argue that many mainstream media outlets are biased against Clinton. How many? How many, I wonder? Perpetuating the total non-scandals of Benghazi and the email server along with Clinton had been cleared by exhaustive investigations of them, right? Really exhaustive. Yeah, Benghazi. You know what they really went down there for, that the ambassador went down there for? Well, see, we had given all these stupid, idiot, obvious ISIS types all these weapons. They're all over the place. So he went down there to quietly gather up these weapons and get them out of there. And that's why they didn't want to give much attention to the story. And that's what led to him getting killed. It wasn't a big operation like it should have been. They wanted to keep it pretty quiet just to gather up all those weapons we'd given those people, and they left it laying around. Yeah, so he got his ass blown off for that. And he knew what he was getting into, too. This kind of conspiracy mongering, wherever it comes from, is tearing not only the Fourth Estate, but also our civil society in general, at precisely the moment when we ought to be reaffirming the values of civic engagement, fact-checking, and responsible speech, as long as you do it our way. Not your way, our way. This, after all, is an election that has already been contested by one of the two major candidates. An extremely dangerous threat to our democracy? We don't have a democracy. When did we vote on going to war in the Middle East? If we were a democracy, we'd be voting all, on all these big subjects that will likely lead to violence on a small scale, one hopes. No, it's going to be on a big scale all over the country, probably after the election, on the part of Trump's most unhinged supporters. This guy is supposed to be unbiased. We're unhinged supporters. Actually, I'm not supporting Donald Trump, because he's going to take the route that they all take after it's all said and done. We've had a president called a liar during his State of the Union speech, which he was. A Supreme Court nominee stalled for purely ideological reasons. Well, that's an important thing to stop it for. That's a very important thing. And a horrifying display of misogyny, racism, and violence for responsible people to contribute in any way to this erosion of our civil society is itself irresponsible. But not me. I'm an expert. Listen to me. This moment is also typified, of course, by an unprecedented eruption of anti-Semitism. I knew he'd get to that. And anti-elitist conspiracy theories fed into anti-Semitic logic. We know that Jews never commit crimes. They're never in the top areas of your government and banking and so forth and Hollywood. That's just a myth. And anti-elitist conspiracy theories feed into the anti-Semitic, anti-Jew logic. The notions that the world is controlled by some shadowy elite that manipulates world opinion and world media, and that you cannot trust the overwhelming consensus surrounding basic facts of history. It is a very short leap from such conspiratorial ideas to the group that has long been associated with them. The Jews. Yeah. They're after us. Just us Jews. Of course, this is not to say that everyone who blames the media is anti-Jew. All. But I do claim that anyone who blames the media is contributing to the resurgence of anti-Jewism by promoting conspiratorial thinking. Are there no conspiracies? Conspiracy is when two people get together to do an illegal act. There must be millions of conspiracies going on all over the world at any one time. Thinking and undermining the basic trustworthiness of our society's central institutions. Well, we don't trust it at all. We can't trust them because they lie, they cheat, and do all these bad things. In theory, you can be a conspiracy monger and not an anti-Jew. But there's a reason 9/11 truthers blame Israel. The fringe of Occupy blamed Jewish bankers, and Trump supporters blame not only the vague international banks. What do you mean vague? You can look them up. It's easy to look into who's the international banks of which their candidate speaks, but also the Jews in particular. Whenever you slide down the slippery slope of conspiratorial paranoia, anti-Jew waits for you at the bottom. Well, look at Goldman Sachs. Isn't that an international bank? Isn't that where the bitch Hillary gets her money, a major part of her money, and where she gets her walking orders, marching orders? In fact, they chose the cabinet for Obama. That's what they did. So disagree with individual columnists, reporters, and news outlets. Raise the profile of issues you care about. Challenge complacency and consensus. But if you're going to blame the media, you might as well blame the Jews. Oh, okay, we'll blame the Jews. Seems like the right thing to do. Here we go. Reports of anti-Jew assaults rose dramatically in the past year, particularly on college campuses. And while there may be a tendency to view all critique of Israel as anti-Jew, a new study finds that there are three major universities, politics are not to blame. Oh. Quote, the anti-Jew that is felt on campus isn't necessarily attached to Israel. It's more like the old stereotype, unquote, Paul Manich, a junior at Rutgers University, said. A new study of anti-Jew hotspots by the Steinhardt Social Research Institute at Brandeis found that at Rutgers, Wisconsin, and Illinois, anti-Jew incidents were linked to general Jew hatred and were less likely to be linked to Israel or the Palestinian conflict. At these schools, where as many as one-third have witnessed anti-Jew harassment, buildings were marked with swastikas, vandals spattered Jewish centers with eggs, and students were verbally assaulted. All. End of the world. They threw an egg at me. That's happening at these schools, echoes the well-documented rise of white nationalism in the wake of Donald Trump's Republican candidacy for president. It is emblematic of what is happening across the country, said Greg Steinberger, executive director of Wisconsin's Jewish group. Quote, in my dorm freshman year, I was asked where my horns were, unquote, one senior told researchers. Manich, who is Rutgers, Hillel's vice president, added, quote, I know students who wear yarmulkes or tits. Sometimes they get things yelled at them. Manich described one incident where a swastika was taped on a student's ceiling, a time where the Shabbat house was vandalized, and comments she has heard about Jews running the school. Pro-Palestinian activism, on the other hand, she said, was not so prevalent. We had a bunch of bad stuff last year. Incidents of anti-Jew are up everywhere, said Steinberger. He described a spate of Nazi graffiti carried out by vagrants, not students, who were later caught. Wow. A city university of New York, Brooklyn College, Northwestern, and many other schools in the University of California system, students reported feeling anti-Israel sentiment. On these campuses, unlike Rutgers in Wisconsin, it appears that the high rates of anti-Jew harassment and hostility are driven mostly by hostility towards Israel. The researchers found that if there is an active chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, a major activist group on the forefront of the boycott movement against Israel, it's very likely that the Jewish groups will perceive a hostile climate toward Israel and the Jews. SJP has come under fire repeatedly for their anti-Jew protests. In February, a Zionist Organization of America accused SJP of fostering anti-Jew climate on CUNY campuses. An independent investigation found that SJP's action at CUNY were protected speech. Radhika Senath, a lawyer with the group Palestinian Legal, which provides legal advice for SJP, questioned the methods of the study, noting that the researchers did not speak with Jewish students who are members of the anti-occupation activist group, Jewish Voice for Peace, or who might otherwise be critical of Israeli human rights abuses. The Brandeis study found that regardless of the anti-Semitism or anti-Jewism and hostility the students may face, their connection to Israel and the Jewish organizations remains strong. In some cases, it may even be strengthened. The level of hostility doesn't seem to affect the engagement of Jewish students. Leonard Sachs, one of the study's leading authors, told Forward, in some cases, it may be doing just the opposite, promoting Jewish students' engagement in being a part of Jewish groups. The findings may be alarming, but even these hot spots, Jewish respondents say anti-Judaism was not their most pressing concern, like other topics like race and diversity or tuition costs, students said felt more urgent than the campus ultimate climate around Israel or Jews. Interesting. Here's an interesting little article written by a Jew. After decades in journalism, you would think that I would be used to this by now. I weathered a barrage of hateful emails when, as the editorial page editor of a major regional newspaper, we took a tough line against President Bill Clinton during his impeachment scandal in the 1990s. I had to deal with nasty reactions to the board's endorsement in a controversial and racially charged local election. Never mind the fact that as editor-in-chief of the Forward Jew paper, I have been the target of vicious criticism from both left and right, questioning the core of my being, that is my very identity as a Jew. Yeah. But nothing quite prepared me for the slew of emails, five altogether, sent in the early hours of October 10th, with the messages such as, Shana Tova, dirty hook-nosed kike rat, may it be your last. And you would make a nice lampshade. And Trump supporters hate kikes. Hail Trump. That one was accompanied by an image of a Nazi soldier holding a gun to an image of my head, photoshopped into a concentration camp uniform, complete with a six-pointed yellow star, Jewish star. The only reason I was not more shaken and horrified is that I know many other Jewish journalists have been on the receiving end of similar disgusting emails, phone calls, and most virulently, messages transmitted through the social media, especially Twitter. The extent of this plague is now codified, thanks to a report released by the Anti-Defamation League's Task Force on Harassment and Journalism. The report proves beyond doubt that anti-Jew against journalism on the social media has increased dramatically during this election campaign, that Jews are far more the main targets, while the report takes pains to say that the surge is not caused directly by the Donald Trump campaign. It is driven by a large measure by those who identify with his candidacy. And while the ADL is postponing its recommendations for counteracting this cyber hate until after the election, it's clear to this reader that Twitter should be doing much more to uphold its own standards of conduct when it comes to confronting anti-Jewism on its platform. The task force analyzed the key words to conclude that from August 2015 through July 2016, there were 2.6 million tweets containing language frequently found in anti-Jew speech. Each one of the top 10 most targeted journalists was Jewish, and they received the vast majority of the anti-Jew tweets. Wow. Not only that, but the ADL found that just 1,600 Twitter accounts generated 68% of the anti-Jew tweets, yet only 21% of those accounts were suspended during that last year. So we have a relatively concentrated cadre of people spewing hate online, and most, nearly 80%, are getting away with it. What the hell of a no? Well, that's enough of that. So you got the story there. All you Twitter tweeters better shape up. No more of this no more of this stuff. Well, let's see what Max is up to today.
Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know, the system is rigged. Markets are rigged. The vote is rigged. Rigged, 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 they say, but who are the riggers? Who gets to draw up the lists? The list not only of the deplorables, but the list of the tolerables, the acceptables. Who writes these lists? Does Stacy write the lists? Possibly. Let's ask her. Stacy, do you write these lists?
I have one name on my list.
Okay.
So, yes, everybody in America is saying that the elections are rigged. Hillary Clinton says that Russia is going to rig the elections. Trump says Hillary is rigging the polls across states across the U.S. The Podesta emails show that Hillary, in fact, did say to banks and bankers in private that she believes the system is rigged, and gosh darn it, Bernie Sanders is capitalizing on that. And how do we stop him from saying this publicly when it should only be private amongst us political elite and you elite bankers who know that the system is rigged? So rigging is something that's really in the population's
right.
mind. And yet they still go out and vote. And I want to really provide some sort of historical context to this. Because
okay.
in the Podesta emails, one of the shocking things is that in 2008, when John Podesta was the transition, he was the transition team guy for Obama. So he helped pick who would be in the cabinet. It turns out that Citigroup actually selected Obama's transition team. So I want to go back to 2 years ago because I have a memory and also access to Twitter. And somebody linked to this from Twitter.
I had a memory. Now I just have social media.
So in 2014, Michael J. Glennon, who is an insider, who was a legal counsel to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, he was also a counsel to the State Department and an advisor to various committees in Congress. So he's a very connected guy. And he wrote a book called National Security and Double Government. And he maintains, here's the headline from Boston Globe regarding his book, written in 2014, by the way, before everybody admonished Trump for saying the election is rigged. Vote all you want, the secret government won't change. So he notes that, you know, voters chose Barack Obama in 2008. For hope and change. He ran on basically a civil liberties platform, that he would shut down all those bad, evil things that George Bush did, like spying on Americans and locking people
up.
Guantanamo Bay. And then he noticed that everybody 6 years in, at the point of this Boston Globe interview, 6 years in, everybody was like, wait, it's a completely the same thing as George Bush's administration. In fact, the drone war escalated. Guantanamo Bay was not shut down. The NSA spying became more aggressive. So he says, why did the face in the Oval Office change, but the policies remain the same? Critics tend to focus on Obama himself, a leader who perhaps has shifted with politics to take a harder line, but Tufts University political scientist Michael J. Glennon has a more pessimistic answer. Obama could not have changed policies even if he tried, because he says of the double government. There's a government that you choose, he says, there's the one we elect, and then there's the one behind it.
Okay, so they're using the term double government instead of shadow government.
Yeah.
Or new world order.
Yeah.
There's a term now called double government.
Yeah.
Okay, double government.
So he comes up with this term double government.
Okay, it's the double government. It's not the shadow government. It's not the cabal. It's not the Rothschilds. It's not New World Order. It's not Alex Jones. It's the double government.
It's the double government.
Okay.
Well, so remember, this guy was an insider, Michael J. Glennon, and he actually says it's more benign. It's just a sort of accidental. They're all nice people, these double government people, the bureaucrats behind the scene that are permanent, that stay there, that they all are individually nice people. But collectively, the fact that you can't change the outcome through your vote is sort of menacing, he says. Elected officials end up serving as a mere cover, he says, for the real decisions made by the bureaucracy. So this bread and circuses of the election every 4 years is just bread and circuses. It's our modern day where we think we have any play in the outcome, and he's saying we don't. And here is an insider who is should know.
Well, this is the arc of history supports this bifurcation, this two-tier system. Going back to the medieval days, there was lords and serfs. Then you had the Enlightenment, and you had the printing press, and you had the dissemination of knowledge. You had the disruption of the church as the guiding force of both society and all of its discontents. But then you had the American Revolution, which was governed by and for the people, and that was a new concept in governance that had not really been seen. It was taking the best from different eras and historically took from the Greeks and the Romans and the French, and they put together the rights of man, and they put together the brilliance of the founding fathers, and this shining city on the hill was there for many decades, 100 years or more. But then the the corruption of the Europeans that America successfully revolted from America effectively detached from. The Bank of England, for example, was outlawed in America until 1913 when they brought in the central bank. The Federal Reserve Bank was a clone of the Bank of England. So that was the beginning of the end. So here we are in 2013, 14, 15, 100 years later, and they're finally the central bankers have won. It's no surprise the central bankers picked the cabinet for Obama.
We're going to go into that because now you could argue that Obama at that time, when he became president in 2008, was kind of ignorant of this double government because he had only been a one-term senator, whereas Hillary Clinton is very clear in her emails that have been leaked. Many in the Beltway are saying, well, it shows how pragmatic and just a normal politician she is. But what she's quite clear about there is that there is one thing to say to the ignorant masses, the lumpen masses, and there's another thing to say in private to the likes of Lloyd Blankfein. And they quite clearly mock and laugh at the activists, at people who care about the vote, people who think their vote can have any sort of say in the outcome. And in fact, Michael J. Glennon, in this interview with the Boston Globe back in 2014, when he asked, well, is there anything to do to stop this double government? And he does bring up that knowledge.
Look, Adam Smith and the Age of Enlightenment and the beginning of classical economics and the idea that you could create price discovery through the greed of all participants in something called the free market worked for a while. But now, to get to your point about rigging, the cost of market rigging and vote rigging has crashed. So it's never been easier for an individual or a small group, a cadre, to rig markets, rig votes, and rig the system.
So he's saying that rigged system requires knowledge and non-ignorance and non-asymmetric information. Information should not be asymmetric. Hillary Clinton clearly demonstrates in her conversations to the bankers that information is asymmetric, in that only they in private can discuss how rigged the system is. Do not tell the public. And what he says when asked how to change the system, he said the ultimate problem is the pervasive political ignorance on the part of the American people and indifference to the threat that is emerging from these concealed institutions. That is where the energy for reform has to come from, the American people, not from government. Government is very much the problem here. The people have to take the bull by the horns, and that's a very difficult thing to do because the ignorance is in many ways rational. There is very little profit to be had in learning about and being active about problems that you cannot affect, policies that you can't change. Again, I say that this sort of understanding is revealed very much in Hillary Clinton's private conversations with bankers when, for example, when she was openly saying, I support fracking, I went around the world supporting fracking, and on the campaign trail she tells the people, I will not allow fracking, I don't want fracking here, but in her private conversations with bankers, she was saying that people who are against fracking should just get a life.
Well, we're moving from a corporal reality of the physical being to one of pure etherealization of the. Now, remember back in the first Clinton presidency, they had the bond vigilantes. You know, the economy was held in check by bond sellers who would force interest rates up if it looked like Bill Clinton was doing the wrong thing. But then the central banks came in and they became the bond market, and now they're gone. Now you have only the Forex market, which is punishing Britain for its stupid Brexit decision. But to attempt to co-opt the entire Forex market, which is a $5 trillion a day market, you're going to see the debt of the globe expand exponentially once again.
So, again, going back to this double government thing that your vote doesn't matter.
Managed by the double government.
And the rigged system. Well, here is another revelation from the WikiLeaks release of the Podesta emails, and the headline reads, the most important WikiLeaks revelation isn't about Hillary Clinton. What John Podesta's emails from 2008 reveal about the way power works and the Democratic Party. But of course, as Michael J. Glennon pointed out, this is about all of the political parties in America. And what they show is that Michael Froman, who is now the U.S. Trade Representative, and he goes around negotiating TTIP and TPP and stuff, but at that point he was an executive at Citigroup, one of the largest banks in America, and this was written in an email October 6, 2008, one full month before you went out to express your democratic rights to determine who the president, who the policies, who what the future of your country would be, at least for the next 4 years. Well, October 6th, and about 2 months before Citigroup received the largest bailout in U.S. history, well, Michael Froman at Citigroup sent an email to John Podesta, who was heading Obama's transition team into the White House, i.e. he would choose his cabinet. Well, Michael Froman, Citigroup, sent an email telling him who the cabinet should be. And, remarkably, the cabinet list ended up being almost entirely on the money. It correctly identified Eric Holder for Justice, Janet Napolitano for Homeland Security, Robert Gates for Defense, Rahm Emanuel for Chief of Staff, Peter Oesterheld for the Office of Management and Budget, Arne Duncan for Education, Eric Chinesky for Veterans Affairs, Kathleen Sebelius for Health and Human Services, Melody Barnes for the Domestic Policy Council, and more. For the Treasury, three possibilities were on the list: Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, and Timothy Geithner.
So Citibank picked the cabinet.
Citigroup picked the cabinet, it would appear.
Yeah.
Perhaps they were on the same page, being in private rooms of the elite, but it seems they chose the cabinet just as Michael Glennon warned the people in 2014.
So the whole Barack Obama's presidency has been a sham in that regard, in that he's done nothing but kowtow to the worst elements of the banking industry in Wall Street.
What it's saying is that as everybody's very excited to go and vote, perhaps there is some truth in what Trump is saying in terms of the election being rigged, but not in the way he's suggesting. But as an outsider, perhaps he doesn't understand how the power maintains itself.
Well, Hillary winning the presidency, I'm pretty sure she's going to impose pretty draconian restrictions on speech.
The point is, the media is very close to Podesta, as we've seen. The emails also reveal that. The media right now is focusing on every vulgarity uttered from Donald Trump, and he does utter many vulgarities, and that is all that they talk about. Nobody is asking her what her head of the transition team is, Ken Salazar. Nobody's asking, well, have you received your list yet, and who is on that list? It should be in the interest of the American population whether or not they want that list for her cabinet. Who is deciding it? Is it Goldman Sachs? Is it J.P. Morgan? Is it, you know, Halliburton? Who knows?
Well said. I mean, the rigging carries on unabated. Well, we got to go to the second half. So stay tuned. Don't go away.
Now, normally I don't carry the last half of Max's show, but the author, an American, has a very good study and a new book out on this financial stuff, and I think we better listen to it.
Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time to go back to New York and talk to Dr. Michael Hudson, author of many books, including his new one, out in just a few weeks. Jay is for Junk Economics. Michael, welcome back.
It's good to be here, Max.
Yeah, if people are looking for a Christmas gift, they should, you know, get ready for this. I can't think of a better thing to see under the Christmas tree than Jay is for Junk Economics by Dr. Michael Hudson. You make a lot of people quite happy, including Santa Claus. Now, let's talk about the book, Dr. Michael Hudson. Jay is for Junk Economics. What is that all about?
Well, it's about the fact that the mainstream economics ignores the kind of thing that you talk about on your show. It ignores debt. It's based on equilibrium theory. It forecasts, basically, is that all the debts can be paid if only you lower wages enough and if you sell off enough of the public domain to pay the bondholders. So mainstream economics is really how to sacrifice the economy to pay the bondholders. And it's not how economics works. And in fact, it didn't used to be how economics works. So what I do is I contrast the classical economics of Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and the others with today. And their idea of free market was a market that was free from predatory finance, free from landlords, free from economic rent, and free from unearned income. And today's economics follows Milton Friedman, who says there is no such thing as a free lunch. But as your viewers know, the economy is all about how to get a free lunch. The economy is all about how Wall Street's ripping off the economy and how the billionaires today aren't really creating jobs, they're destroying jobs. That's how they become richer billionaires. So you have a contrast between what economic theory says and reality economics, how the world really works.
You mentioned equilibrium theory. I want to stay on that for a second. So in other words, if people read the financial press here in the UK or in the US, a lot of times when the going gets tough, let's say people realize that Brexit is a colossal failure and a mistake, you'll find somebody in the Telegraph will write an editorial, Evans Pritchard, for example, where they'll pull out some equilibrium theory, you know, that, well, you don't understand. According to this equilibrium theory, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is a great way to mask failure is by putting an equal sign in amongst a bunch of gobbledygook and call that economics. As you point out, there was a pre-period in economics where stuff was to protect us from these charlatans. And then now they've taken over, right?
That's what they do. Equilibrium means if there's any adjustment, everything goes back to normal. And the reality, any mathematician who looks at economics, who's not trained in economics, realizes that when there is a disturbance and something gets out of balance, it gets more and more out of balance until there's a crisis. You've had Steve Keen on your show, and he's a good mathematician, and he points this out, that the junk economics uses junk mathematics. It's all based on diminishing returns. For instance, all the textbooks that you're trained in talk about marginal utility theory. And the idea is if you get more and more apples or wealth, you're satiated and it becomes less important to you. But the fact is, already in the ancient Greeks, they knew about wealth addiction. They knew that once you get wealthy, you have more and more of an addiction to wealth. You have more and more of a drive for it. It's just exactly the opposite from diminishing marginal utility. Also, the statistics junk economics uses, it assumes there's no such thing as exploitation. There's no unproductive labor. There's no free lunch. It's as if they now treat crime as part of the gross national product. In fact, in Italy just begun reporting crime as part of output because it said, well, that's the market. If we're talking about the market, let's talk about the embezzlement, the robbery, all the other things. So there's a whole mushiness over what does it mean to have output? If we're going to have Goldman Sachs and the financial sector taking interest, is this really what we want? Is that output or is it paid for out of industry and labor? I'll give you an example of Greece. Suppose that a country owes debt equal to 100% of its GDP. Now, if the interest rate is 5% and the country is growing only at 2%, then all of the economic growth, all of the growth up to the interest rate has to be paid to the creditors. And since right now Europe and America are only growing at 1% or 2%, and the interest rate that people have to pay on their mortgages, credit cards, companies are much higher, all of the growth in the American and European economy is going really to the financial sector, and that's the 1%. Now, the orthodox economics, like even Mr. Piketty, with all of his statistics, he says, well, it must be inherited wealth, that's the problem. But the real problem is not that wealth is inherited, it's that all the wealth is financialized. It's all going to pay the banks and the real estate investors and the insurance company and what the national income statistics call the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. And if you subtract the FIRE sector from GDP, you find out actually that the European and American economies have been shrinking steadily in the last decade, not growing at all. It's an illusion that there's growth. There's actually been shrinking, and you don't get this in the mainstream economics, and that's why it's basically a kind of public relations for Wall Street.
I've often thought about this, that as you acquire wealth, the risk of acquiring more wealth diminishes. And when people talk about, the way I resolve this in my own thinking is that when people talk about wealth redistribution, they'd be better served to talk about risk redistribution. In other words, for the wealthy, their cost of funds should not go down. They should actually go up to make some equilibrium, if there's true equilibrium, in the economy. And also, let me go out on a limb here. You talked about Greece. And what was the thinking back in ancient times? What didn't Aristotle have a parable about olive trees or olive about he had, one olive tree was good, two was great, but three was too many or something? Did I dream that, or is that based in reality somewhere?
I don't remember Aristotle saying that. I know that Aristotle did talk about when people began to get wealthy, they became addicted to it, and they wanted more and more and more. And the Greeks had a word for it, kleonexia, too much of a surplus. And the whole Greek concept of hubris was not only arrogance of wealth, but arrogance that injured other people. So the vocabulary that Aristotle used recognizes that hubris and arrogance and wealth involves an injury to other people. And that was why it was bad. So it's not just that wealth is something positive. There's a negative side of the balance sheet. And if wealth has come by exploiting other people, by reducing them to bondage, by reducing them, ultimately to serfdom, that's not real wealth at all. That's simply economic polarization.
Right. And contrast that with one of Warren Buffett's favorite quotes from Mae West. Too much of a great thing is great, is not enough. So clearly a complete contrast in thinking. Now, to follow up on this point, you talk about the myth of the banker god is the hardest for all of myths for the population to give up, that the financial sector is a necessary part of production and consumption. But you kind of disagree with this. But the banker god, this is part of this, correct?
Well, yeah. In 2008, the bank said, in order to save the economy, you have to save us. And the reality is that the economy had a choice back in 2008. Either it could save the banks and the bondholders by sacrificing Ireland to pay the crooked banks, sacrificing Greece, sacrificing the 10 million American homeowners, or it could save the economy. And what the banks really said was, you need us not to shut down your ATM machines. We're going to create a crisis and take away your means of payment because you don't have a public option. You need us private banks because you have not put in place a fail-safe position so that a public bank can really provide the means of payment. If we declare war on you and we're holding you up for hostage, for ransom, if you don't give us everything we want and bail out the banks for bad losses on their junk mortgage loans and their fraudulent loans and their derivative ripoffs, then they'll close down the economy. And that doesn't mean that you need the banks. It means that the banks have a chokehold on you.
So the governor of Minnesota, who is a Democrat, has said that Obamacare is officially unaffordable for the state. 5% of the population will face the full premium price rise of 60% for 2017. What happens next for Obamacare?
It's going to become more and more expensive. I was the economist for Dennis Kucinich when he ran in 2008. And he tried to get in Congress the public option and the Democratic Leadership Committee, both from Pelosi and from in the Senate, would not even permit a public option to be discussed in Congress. So it was a giveaway to the pharmaceutical industries that had paid these politicians huge amounts of corrupt money. To guarantee that Obamacare was going to make the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies and the stockholders behind them, mainly the 1%, very, very rich. You had early in the presidential campaign Trump coming out and saying, hey, a public option obviously is the more efficient. Bernie Sanders was right. But now he's turned around and accused falsely Hillary of supporting a public option, when you can be sure neither candidate is going to support the public option. They're all in the hands of the insurance industry. And so between banking and health care, health insurance, and real estate, the average worker in America doesn't have very much money to buy goods and services, and that's why the economy's shrinking, that's why employment's shrinking, and that's why the employment that is taking place is all part-time and temporary.
Well, we've got about 20 seconds left. So the current debt in America officially is approaching $20 trillion. Is there an end to that? We've only got about 10 seconds, but can that just keep going?
Yes, it can't be paid. We're in a position of grace. There's a basic principle: debt that can't be paid won't be. The question is, how won't they be paid? Will it be by foreclosure or and concentration of the 1%, or will it be a debt write-down?
All right, got to cut her off there. Dr. Michael Hudson, thanks for being on the show.
Good to be here.
Well, can you see or hear the writing on the wall? It's slowly picking up. It's slowly coming at us. Better make your personal plans for living on a lot less. It's going to hit. We don't know exactly when, but it's going to hit. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Tears Day.
Cheer up, man. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, your life chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on, don't give up.
Always look on.
Great for a guy like me, just to be in a coma. Wouldn't that be great? Boy, you know, you just crap out, nothing to do all day. You breathe through a fucking tube, they feed you through a tube, and nothing to do. That's really living, you know what I mean? No phone calls coming in, nobody dropping by unexpectedly. And if they do drop by, you're completely unaware of it. Because you're in a fucking coma. And you're practically clinically dead. And you don't have to listen to their stupid bullshit. Their stupid bullshit. Like about their new ride around lawnmower with the two-tone horn and the GPS in case they get lost on the lawn. And their boss and their job and their car.
This is Walter Dennis.